Good evening and welcome to the Métis Voices radio show. And as you can see, this week we've got our music going again. The Métis Voices radio is our own internet radio program at BBS Radio every Friday evening at 8 o'clock p.m. Pacific Standard Time, Station 2, featuring a variety of subjects and special guests each week from all over, live from the Machif Métis Museum in beautiful Vavenby, BC, Canada, with your host, Dale Haggerty. Call-in lines are now open, as well as a chat feature for your questions and comments. Here are the numbers to call. In the U.S. and Canada, toll-free 888-228-4494. And worldwide, toll-free 877-489-6350. For direct lines, go to www.bbsradio.com, BBS Station 2 on the right-hand side. And don't worry if you miss any of these call-in numbers. They are posted on the BBS Radio website. And those who wish to enter the BBS live chat rooms, please go to the home page, column on the left, go to How to Listen, then down to Chat Live, BBS My Chat Rooms, choose the drop-down menu, select Chatter Hall. Sign in if you're already registered or registered if you're not already. And now, your host, Dale Haggerty.
Tansay, everyone. Welcome to Métis Voices radio program this Friday, August the 8th. With the election soon to be held in the near future, we are carrying on the campaign trail. Tonight, we have the privilege to have as our guest, our good friend and Métis brother, Kelly LaRondelle. Hello, Kelly.
Hello.
Glad to have you on the show tonight. Well, let's start out with a few questions for you there, my good boy. First of all, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and where you were born, and were you raised in the Métis community, and are you living, and where are you living now?
Sure. Well, my name is Kelly LaRondelle. I also have another name given to me by my great-grandmother, which is Machescosesis, which means little swallow in Cree. I was born in Edmonton, Alberta, and lived in Fort McMurray when I was just a baby. But when I was about 5 years old, I moved out west and grew up on Vancouver Island in a little place called Black Creek, which is between Courtney and Campbell River on Vancouver Island.
Yeah, you were born in Edmonton. Well, so was I. That's a good little Métis city we heard about there.
Yeah, just a little one.
Just a little one in the west. So where are you living now?
I am currently living in Hello. Can you hear
me
out there?
Go ahead, Kelly.
Oh, I was just wondering if you can hear me out there.
Oh, they just had a little bit of technical difficulties with our voices. So how is everybody now there? So, anyways, you said you were living in New Westminster?
Yeah, I've just recently moved to New Westminster in the Lower Mainland. But I'm working in East Vancouver right now.
Okay. So, Kelly, you're the founder and the interim executive director of KEA. What does KEA stand for? And can you tell us a little about this group and then your involvement?
Yes. KEA is an acronym, and it stands for Knowledgeable Aboriginal Youth Association, and it's been running for about 5 years now. When I was younger, I was involved with, well, at that time I was involved with the Native Youth Movement when I was younger, when I first got my start. And we were young activists of youth who were trying to speak up and speak out about different issues that concerned us. And unfortunately, we never had any platform or any organization that was assisting young people to get their voices heard, young Aboriginal or Métis youth. But from there, as I got a little bit older and started to have my own family and went back to school, I started realizing that that there needed to be an organization that could advocate for Aboriginal youth voice and representation and participation, trying to get more young Aboriginal people involved in processes and in issues that affect their life or that will affect their children's or grandchildren's life. And where I got my start was with an organization in Burnaby called Arrows to Freedom Cultural Healing Society. I started out as a summer practicum student. From there, I kind of worked my way up into different positions. And at that time, the executive director there at the time, her name was Victoria Stevens, she encouraged me to attend different processes and meetings that I thought was important to the organization or to the youth or the community of Burnaby. And what happened was I started going to various meetings and processes with government or with community, and I realized right away that at all those meetings and processes that I was generally the youngest person there. And at that time, I was in my mid-20s, about 24 or 25. And at first, I was a bit intimidated going into those processes. You know, I didn't know the language or the lingo. You know, I didn't know all the acronyms that correlated to government processes or organizations. I didn't quite fully understand how decisions were being made, because a lot of the decisions are made by what's called Robert's Rules of Order, where you make motions and you have a seconder and things like that. So when I first came into these processes, I was pretty intimidated, being a young man and wanting to do a good job, but not fully comprehending of how the processes actually worked. So as I gained my experience and as I worked my way up the ladder as from a practicum summer student, to becoming like a family and youth worker, and I worked my way all the way up there to the interim executive director. And through those couple years, I started speaking up more, started asking more questions. I had some mentors in the community that took me under their wing, people like Jerry Adams from Urban Native Youth Association, or David Stevenson, who used to work with Vancouver Aboriginal Council at the time. And some of my peers, like Melanie Mark or David DeCoyne or Dave Dennis. And so I started speaking up a lot more and started asking more questions. And so through that, that's where I first kind of got my start. But through that, I also realized that there needed to be someone or that there needed to be an organization that advocated for young people to be involved with these processes. But there also needed to be like a peer network or peer transfer of information going on, because the language that it was discussed in often isn't understood by young people, or else it turns young people off very quickly. And so, for example, if I brought a young person into a meeting with could be anything, maybe Ministry of Children and Families that was being held at the Friendship Center, and I went in, let's say, the Simon Baker Room, most of those young people would last about 10 minutes and would kind of shut down or either get up and leave, because it doesn't engage them and it doesn't interest them, even though that a lot of the things being discussed would probably are really important to those young people. What happened was working 3 hours to freedom. I always had a dream of becoming an Aboriginal support worker in the school district, because years prior to that, I had job shadowed a woman named Wanda Dexel in the Coquitlam School District, or in the Burnaby School District, sorry. And for 2 weeks, I worked with her, and I thought, boy, this is the coolest job ever. You get paid really good, you get your summers off, you get to do all these cultural amazing things with kids in schools. And I was like, I want your job. So I'd set that goal for myself 4 years earlier. And at the time, I was working at Arrows Freedom still. And I came across an ad in the Cat2 newspaper and for an Aboriginal support worker in the Coquitlam School District. So sure enough, I applied, and right away, right in the interview, I knew I had it. And I got a phone call, and they offered me the job. But I wasn't sure whether I wanted to take it for sure, because I really enjoyed working at Arrows to Freedom Cultural Healing Society, because it was such a cultural organization, really family-run, and really enjoyed my job there. So I thought about it and realized that if I didn't take this job with the Coquitlam School District, I'd probably regret it and always wonder, well, what if, what would have happened? So I ended up taking that job, and was very successful at it. Worked in 13 different schools in the Coquitlam School District, doing different cultural workshops, but also academic tutoring. It was an amazing experience, but I found out right away that I didn't like how the public school structure, Aboriginal education worked. I didn't like the bureaucratic structure of it. I felt that the Aboriginal people that worked there didn't have enough say into the programming. The community didn't have enough say into the funding or programs. Although I thought what they were doing was beneficial, I just didn't think it was enough, community-driven enough. So I realized that even though I accomplished my dream of getting that job, that I wasn't quite, I didn't feel, I guess, a very enough purpose, or I wasn't completely happy. And so I started brainstorming about this idea for a youth organization that would advocate for Aboriginal youth voice and representation. And I was brainstorming, and I also knew the really importance of acronyms. How if you had a really good acronym, it sticks in your mind. It's almost like marketing, like a slogan or something. And so one night I was laying in. Oops, sorry. Still there? Hello?
Yeah. Still here, yeah, okay. Yeah, go ahead, yeah.
Okay, so one night I went out to a movie, and it was kind of funny because I watched the movie 8 Mile, which is about a rapper, and I really like this guy's music. His name's Eminem. But I went and watched the movie, and I was really inspired by his story of how he came from a little trailer park to becoming, internationally known and, achieved his dreams. And it just inspired me that night. And I went home and went to bed, and I was thinking about this movie and thinking also about my idea for this organization. And so I was brainstorming about, well, if I did try and make an organization, what would it be called? And I was thinking, it has to be something that really represents, youth advocacy and something that represents my vision. So I started brainstorming in my head, and I was like, okay, Knowledgeable Aboriginal Youth Advocates. And I was like, Kaya. And I was like, Kaya, that's it. And I just knew right there that was the name. And I just sat up out of bed, and I woke my partner up at the time, and I said, told her, I was really excited. I said, I thought of it. It's Kaya. It's Knowledgeable Aboriginal Youth Advocates. And then I said, well, I wish I was brave enough to write a proposal. I've never written a proposal in my life. And my partner at the time, her name was Jamie Dexel, She said, you know what? You are, and you should get out of bed right now, and you should start writing your ideas down. And this was on a Sunday night, and I also knew of some funding, some youth funding, that was coming up, and the deadline was a week away. So I got up that Sunday night, and I stayed up till 4 in the morning writing down all the ideas of what this organization would do. Basically, that it was a youth-driven organization, that all the staff would be youth, that the organization would be run by youth and guided by youth, and that all decisions would be made by youth, and that it would advocate for youth in various community processes, government processes. It would translate processes into youth-friendly language, and then would use different forms to do this, so contemporary and traditional forms. So whether it was using hip-hop or graffiti or traditional art or traditional ceremony. And so I wrote all these ideas down. And so the next day I was supposed to go to work in the Coquitlam School District. I was still working there. And I decided to play sick for a couple days. And I started writing all my ideas down. And luckily, through my involvement with Arrows to Freedom Cultural Healing Society, I'd met a lot of various managers and executive directors and had a really good rapport with most of them. So I started going around and telling them about my idea and asking for support. And so I got letters of support from probably about 20, you know, organizations in Vancouver. I had a couple of my peers help me out, David DeCoyne at the time, Melanie Mark, and a few others. And so I just kept on writing, and I by the end of the week, I had a proposal written, and it was for two employees and Arrows to Freedom. I approached them to be a host organization, because I didn't have an organization, and they agreed, and I submitted the proposal. So months later, because it takes a while for them to view the proposals, I found out it came in first from all those proposals, and it got funded fully, and it was for me at the time, it was a lot of money. It was around $80,000, and it got funded, and that was 5 years ago. And so that's kind of the story of how Kaya got started. And from there, we've done amazing things and done some amazing programs. We've had the opportunity to travel internationally. We've been able to go to Africa, to the United Nations, and participate there, to New York at the United Nations and to participate there and advocate for Indigenous youth voice to be involved, to community levels, like create a youth police working group with the Vancouver police department. We've also created a music recording studio, and we're now working on our fourth CD. We have a multi-purpose art studio, free for Aboriginal youth to use, and the youth that utilize that art studio have now decided they want to create their own organization. So now we're the host organization for what's called the Native Youth Arts Collective, and Skeena Reese is spearheading that up. We've had a breakdance program that started in the parking garage, the underground parking garage of the Friendship Center, who has now also become their own organization that's called Rhythm and Action Arts. So we've done amazing things, and it's got a full board of directors that are all youth, 29 and under. All the staff are youth, excluding myself now, because I'm 32. And what had happened was I had mentored a younger girl named Geraldine Webster to take over my job because I was getting older and I wanted it to keep on running as a youth-driven organization. And also, as I got older, I realized that I was, I guess I could say I was quite professional in process. I knew exactly how Robert's Rules of Order worked. I knew exactly how to lobby. I knew exactly how to advocate. And I could operate within those processes. But I started to realize that younger people may not operate like that, and that I gained that experience. And younger people might say, no, this doesn't work for me, and I don't agree how we're operating. And they might speak up and speak out about that. And I think that's good. And I don't think that's encouraged enough in our community.
Yep.
And so I realized that Gerilyn Webster was a very outspoken, bright young lady. Not only was she outspoken, she was an amazing artist, actress, producer, hip-hop singer. She just encompassed all these different gifts, and that a lot of young people could relate to. She could engage younger people at her age at like 21 than I could at 30. So I approached her about being mentored to become the executive director, and she agreed, and so she's been the executive director for the last year and a half. And she is now going on maternity leave, so they approached me about returning as the interim executive director for a short period of time, and I gladly agreed, because it's my dream job, and it's also being the founder, it's kind of like your baby, and it's something that I would always help out. And so I was very happy to return, and I've been there about a month now as the interim executive director.
That's good to hear. Now, listen, I got a couple questions to ask you about this thing. Now, listen, I'm just going to give you an example. For example, I have lots of people still living on the Lower Mainland, and I'm the ear that everybody phones up and talks to me about. They're having problems with the Surrey School Board about cultural workers in there, and
right.
And one lady apparently has approached one of the school directors, I guess, that's running the Aboriginal program, and she has told her that now the Aboriginal programs are only going to be run in Surrey, are going to be West Coast Aboriginal people. First Nation, and now what we're saying, what she's trying to tell me is that Métis and the First Nation brothers from Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Alberta, and the rest of the country, they're not going to be teaching their culture, their ways, and is there still somewhere out there that people, like he says, you. And it's our youth that's where our identity is. They're going to get lost. Now, what would you say to something like that?
Well, that's a really good example. I think, like, if with Kaya, like, if someone phoned us and said, told us about that, whether it was a parent, a youth, an elder, it doesn't matter who, we would be glad to assist. And what we would probably do is hold an event, most likely in Surrey, invite youth out who live there, who go to school there, and maybe some parents or anybody. And we would probably just have a dialogue about what the school's district is saying. But we would probably also have some fun, too, because some of these things, to engage young people, you need to provide, I always say you need to provide the basics. When the basics are food, transportation and childcare, because a lot of young people have children these days as well. So those are just the basics. But then you need to also throw in some fun. So you need to have some entertainment of some sort, whether that be some traditional entertainment or maybe a hip-hop singer. And then I think there, above all that, there needs to also be incentives. So when Kaya holds an event, we usually have some kind of cool incentive. Maybe we might have concert tickets to an upcoming concert, or maybe like an iPod or something cool that young people would like that might actually want get them to come out beyond food and a bus ticket, but come out. And what my reasoning for this, and some people, there's a debate about this, some people say that they think that it's almost a way of bribery, but I disagree. I think that when you consult people, whether they're young or old, that they should be acknowledged for the information they're giving, and that information is very valuable. So that's probably how I'd approach it. And then we'd have a session, and a facilitated session with youth facilitators, and sometimes we do what are called urban cafes, which are set up to be kind of like a cafe environment where you're just kind of talking about, you know, current issues, and mixed in with entertainment, and then you might have a bit of entertainment, then you go back to tables and you mix up maybe some elders and youth, and then you put some posed questions. So you could put a question out like, what kind of programming, Aboriginal programming, do you think the Surrey School District should have? And I can guarantee you will not get the answer, we only want West Coast. If you look at the population and demographics in Surrey, I guarantee that the minority of Aboriginal people and young people that go to the Surrey School District would probably be West Coast. I guarantee that the majority would probably be out of province, First Nations, or Métis people. So that's a really serious issue that you brought up, and it actually intrigues me and now makes me want to look more into that. But I think another thing, too, to realize is all the school districts in the province are undergoing what's called Aboriginal Enhancement Agreements. And I've been involved with CAIA, with the Vancouver School District's one, for the last couple years. And where they public school districts have to engage community and consult community to enhance Aboriginal education and programming. And so that's another way of tackling it, is what's going on with their enhancement agreement? Has it been signed off yet? And if it hasn't, what kind of community consultation? Is that public knowledge? Can we see that in any kind of consultation? And if we haven't been, if Métis people haven't been consulted, well, then we'd say, well, you need to consult Métis people. So that's an example.
Okay, that's good. I'm glad, because you're going to be getting a couple phone calls, because I hope the listeners that are listening tonight, because that was one of the questions that was emailed to me earlier. So, how would they get a hold of you?
Okay, well, there's a number of ways. My email is kayareports@hotmail.com. So that's kayareports@hotmail.com. So that's my email. You can also reach me at Kaya, and the phone number is 604-254-5513. And Kaya's website, which is just being... some updates are being done, but it will be up in the next week or two, is www.kayaweb.net.
Okay, that's great, Kelly. Thank you very much. So, going on to my next question, you're also a board member of the Center for Native Policy Research and the Native Education College Advocate for Aboriginal Representation. Is this the same as Kaya?
The Center for Native Policy and Research is a separate organization, which is trying to do Aboriginal research that's done by Aboriginal people. And the Native Education Center, or Native Education College as it's now called, is the college in East Vancouver that's the only Aboriginal private governed college in the province, and it's the oldest one, and that's down on East 6, and its location is in a West Coast longhouse. And I'm actually a graduate from there. I graduated from family community counseling in 2000, and that course and that school really changed my life and really kind of put me on the path to where I am now, and it gave me the tools to go work at Arrows to Freedom, which later led to, you know, the school district and CAIA. I've also worked at UNN, United Native Nations. I've also worked at Vancouver Aboriginal Coastal Planning Committee. Can I say one thing about the Native Education Center College, though?
Oh, you betcha. I want you to talk. Go ahead.
Okay, great, great. So the Native Education Center College is an amazing college, and it's been around for about 40 years now. And how I became a board member is last year there was an email that went out to the community that said Native Education Center is about to close its doors this summer due to, you know, insufficient funding, not enough enrollment, and I think there was one more reason. I can't even remember. But when I had seen that email, I could not believe that this organization that's been around for 40 years, that is the largest Aboriginal-governed school of its kind, and in the cultural setting that it's in a longhouse that's such a beautiful building, that could ever close. And so I responded that second I seen that email, and I just put out an email and I said, not if I am alive and breathing, and that will this place ever close down. And I just mass emailed that out to everybody, people I didn't know, people I knew, and I just said, let's just have a meeting. And so we organized a meeting at the Native Education Center, then we had another one at the Friendship Center, and over 125 people came out. And it was different people. It was students, it was elders, it was teachers. There was past graduates who are, some of them are now lawyers and professors, and work in various places of leadership. And, so I also was working with, my friend Dave Dennis at the time, who's the vice president of United Native Nations. And we helped work with some of the teachers and some of the students and some of the other people in the community to organize a protest. And it just happened that same week, the Minister of Advanced Education was not even 8 blocks down, going to be doing an announcement of a $55 million project at Vancouver Community College. And so that just shocked me even more. I was like, here we have, in the same 10-block radius, an Aboriginal governed school that has produced lawyers and doctors and people of leadership and has just produced amazing, amazing people. And in the same 10-block radius, you have $55 million going into Vancouver Community College. And it's nothing against Vancouver Community College. It's just the irony of it when the government is announcing a new relationship with Aboriginal people. Well, it's loud and clear. If you live in the city, if you are an urban person, there is no new relationship with you. You're not in that new relationship. So we organized this march, and it was amazing. We had a couple hundred people come out. Most all of the teachers from the college, past people who helped build that college, students, different organizations like executive directors, and we marched down there and we interrupted this announcement and confronted Murray Cole. And from that, there was Murray Cole agreed to meet with leadership. And so from there, he met with the Leadership Council and the United Native Nations. And we were able to have discussions. And anyways, the long and the short of it is we've been able to keep the school open. And so what happened was I ran when their AGM came on their board and got on their board. And it's starting to turn around now. And I believe that school should be open for another 40 years. And I have an 8-year-old son who was born when I went to school there. In 2000, when I graduated, right before I graduated, my son was born. And I hope that my son goes to that school. So that's just a little story about Native Education Center, and I just want to promote it and just, encourage people to look into it. If you're thinking about going back to school, whether you're 17 or whether you're 80 years old, it's an amazing school, and it's a life-changing school, and it's such an amazing environment because of the setting that it's in, and, you know, native teachers, and it's really like a family environment in there.
Yeah, it sounds good. Sounds good. And I encourage that the young people, if you're having problems, again, you know, with our school system, I mean, it's not for everybody. I agree. You've just said it way it is. It's a good environment. It's good, friendly, and it's probably where our native people or Aboriginal people can understand and go through this stuff. So, and I was reading in your bio here, and that recently you have engaged at the local, provincial, and the national and international level, speaking at the UN in Africa. Very interesting. Give us a. Oh, you were touching about on it, but go ahead.
Okay, so you want to know a little bit about our experience going to the United Nations?
Yeah, you know, you're a youth.
Yeah.
Now you're facing the world.
Well, it's an amazing story, and that trip really changed my life as well. And what happened at the time is we were working with an organization. Kaya was working with, it's a non-Aboriginal organization, but an amazing organization called the Environmental Youth Alliance in Vancouver. And they were gearing up to take a delegation of some young people to Africa to the 25th Governing General Assembly. And they had been working with some youth groups in Africa, in Kenya, in some of the biggest slums in the world. And so they were supporting some of the youth-driven projects there. And at that time, amazing man named Curtis Clearsky worked with me at Kaya. And we were pretty much the two main employees at the time. And he was a project coordinator. And he was a hip-hop artist as well. And at that time, the UN was, and the Environmental Youth Alliance was helping. They were started this new initiative called Messengers of Truth. And so what they realized is that hip-hop was a universal youth language, that many youth related to hip-hop, and that a lot of the lyrics in hip-hop, and I'm not saying like gangster rap or anything like that, but some of that too. But a lot of that relates to their issues in their life, and they relate to it. And so they were picking 50 hip-hop artists from around the world to be inducted as messengers of truth for the United Nations. And so Environmental Youth Alliance helped promote Curtis Clearsky and Kaya. And so they decided that they, after listening to Curtis Clearsky's music, who he sings a lot about dignity, he sings a lot about of our community and a lot of the struggles we've gone through and a lot of his personal struggles that he went through as a young person, being young and kind of being on, you know, involved with street life to getting a little bit older and to be working, you know, in the community and now working with youth who are in that street life. So, long and short of it is Curtis was going to go, and my other friend named Stan Williams, Mohawk fella, was going there, and he was involved, and he was going to go as in the Canadian delegation as a youth representative. So Curtis and Stan were going to go, and they were going to go with Environmental Youth Alliance. And unfortunately, the last minute, Curtis was unable to get his passport in time. And so there was an opening to go. And so Curtis said, well, you're the next logical choice, you know, the executive director of Kaya. And he said, you should go. So I applied for my passport. I had a week to get it. I had about a week to get there. I needed about $3,000 for my ticket. I didn't have the money. And I phoned around, and I managed to get about a $1,500 donation from the BC Association of Friendship Centers, and I still needed $1,500. And at that time, there was a chief AFN assembly down at the one of the big hotels in Vancouver. And I just went down there, and in the lobby, I happened to see Phil Fontaine, and I just went right up to him, and I grabbed his hand, I shook his hand, I told him who I was, told him what I was doing. I said, I need $1,500 to get to Africa in a week. And they did a blanket dance, and I got, I think, about $1,600, bought my ticket. I picked up my passport the day I was leaving and went to Africa.
Oh, that's a close, my friend.
Yeah. So we got there, and what we did was we put on an international urban cafe. And so what that was it was we had roundtable dialogue sessions and then intermixed with performances. And we were able to get about five performance groups from Kibera, one of the slums in Africa. And one was a hip-hop group. One was like a cultural performance group, similar to like a West Coast performance group. One was a street acrobat group. And I think the other one was a hip-hop group. And then we also had our kind of group. And so we put on this big event. We had coffee. We had some snacks. We advertised it all over on the UN compound in Africa. And it was the first time that any of those, that there was ever that, you know, young people who lived on the slums even allowed in that compound, for one. And we had this big event. And so throughout the day, one of them was a soccer group, too. Because soccer is really big over there. So throughout the day, these groups would perform, but they would also speak about how that was letting them survive in a way where they didn't have to do crime. Because before, most of them did crime. They had to rob or steal to survive. And so now they were doing these different groups, whether it was this amazing street acrobat group or this amazing hip-hop group or this amazing cultural group. And so they would speak about their experience. And throughout the day, different heads of states came in, and they would come in and they would listen to a performance. And then in between the performance, there would be dialogue at the tables with these youth and with decision makers. And there would be set questions. And it was an amazing, amazing event. And afterwards, there was a big dinner, and you got to see the scope. I mean, just on the UN compound alone, there's 4,000 delegates there. And out of those 4,000 delegates, you can count the indigenous people on your hand, for one. You know, there's probably like six indigenous people there. So me and Stan, and there was a few others from Vancouver that were there that helped put this on. And so afterwards, we were invited to this big feast that the executive director of the United Nations was putting on, of UN Habitat. It was UN Habitat. And as these youth walked from where we were doing a thing to this dinner, the security guards were all stopping them and didn't know, we're going to kick them out. And luckily, one of our friends, his name's Marcel Swain, I believe he's the executive director of Illuminative Housing, seen what was going on and kind of intervened, and we got these young people into this dinner. But we also fundraised money at it as well, and the money went to a youth soccer group that was helping put our youth soccer on in the slums. And all this was leading to is what we were trying to promote was messengers of truth, like contemporary forms of engagement with young people was one of our goals. More youth at the UN. So more youth delegates, more youth being involved in decisions, because they make these huge solutions there that involve millions of dollars of funding, and also trying to encourage a youth fund for these type of youth projects that are, you know, like micro projects that, you know, even $100 with one of these projects would sustain them, you know, for a long time. So that was a bit of my experience in Africa. We also, there was a youth forum there that we participate, and we there was a youth resolution, and so we were able to help get, as part of the resolution, Indigenous youth involvement in that resolution. And it was such an amazing experience. Like, the experience is, because it's so fast-paced, and you need to lobby people, and you need to do it on the fly. And you're lobbying people from all over the world, from different countries. And so some are more, I guess, liberal, right? Like more, you know, like Sweden or somewhere, you know, they're just in there with us, or Switzerland or somewhere like that. They're just, you know, totally supportive of what we're trying to do. And we were really loud and outspoken, and we were running around the UN with like cameras on our shoulders, and we were just, you know, just going all out, and we weren't scared to kind of speak up and speak out. And then you have other groups there that are religious-based groups that were, or other countries that were just totally against, you know, youth involvement or contemporary forms of engagement, like hip-hop. So it was an amazing experience, and ended up meeting some amazing young people. And they had this, we worked with this youth group there that was called the One Stop Youth Hub, and they had been given a train station. And so when we went there, you know, as Canadians, we went there with capacity. And I mean, when I mean that, we went up there with capacity up our yin-yang. You know, we've got food, we've got a place to stay, we had a driver who drove us around, we've got laptops, we got printers, we've got everything. When we went to this youth place, you know, they didn't have electricity. And the amazing programming, though, that was going on there, and the level of involvement of their youth with the governance there way surpassed Canadians, was the amazing thing. So yet, we go there as young people with all this capacity and education, but they have youth government there. They have youth parliament there. They have youth parties there. And that blew me away, and that really opened up my perspective around youth, advocating for youth representation and trying to bring it to a different level. Because if these young people in Africa who have a youth center who doesn't even have electricity, and when they do workshops, you know, it would be packed. There would be like 50 youth there, like every day, like dedicated volunteers who wouldn't work for any money but would be like a full-time employee. And one of them actually came back to Canada, and we hired him at Kaya for about a half a year. And so that's just a little bit about my experience there. But amazing experience.
Yeah. So listen, rumors are going around that you're running for the position of Vice President of the United Native Nations. Tell us what you're doing, and give us some idea why you're running and what you can accomplish.
Okay. Well, those aren't rumors. That is a fact. And I am definitely running, and I'm definitely confident that I will be the next vice president. I'm running also with my friend, Mr. Dave Dennis, who is currently the vice president of United Native Nations. I guess I used to work at United Native Nations after Kaya. After I mentored Geralyn, I moved on to starting up a youth governance initiative at United Native Nations. And so that's where I'll kind of start, is that I worked there for about a year and a half, and I got funding to go around the province and engage young people and try to start up a provincial governance process that was there for urban and non-status and Métis youth. And so I was very successful. I was able to get almost about, I guess my year and a half, probably about $500,000 in funding to go around the province. And what came out of that is now a year and a half later, we have five provincial roundtables, youth roundtables, that consist of youth from ages 13 to 29. Each roundtable has anywhere from 15 to 50 youth. There's one on the island, there's one in Vancouver, there's one in the interior, Okanagan, there's one in Prince George, and there's one in Prince Rupert. So we traveled around the province, and I hired Rebecca Jules, who's an amazing youth worker and youth advocate in our community. And we went around the province and engaged young people and asked them, how do they want to be engaged? What's important to them? And how do they want to get involved with governance? And so from that, they created five roundtables. Each roundtable has peer elected representatives. Those peer elected representatives then make up a provincial youth council, and they peer elect an executive, so a male and a female rep. And so last year at the UNN AGM, I was still working there, and I was able to get about 20 youth from the youth governance up in Smithers involved with the AGM. We also gave them training. We gave them board governance training, gave them different types of training around proposal writing, different training around youth engagement. And so when they came to the AGM last year, they were, a lot of them themselves were young leaders working in their communities. And so they were very knowledgeable coming to the AGM and were quite involved with helping create resolutions, helping ask some hard questions around the governance of UNN. And they put forward a resolution last year to have a male and female youth representative on the board of directors. But what happened is it needs to be a special resolution. So we compromised and we said we'll have a committee and we'd still have a male and female rep. And so as time went on, I went on to work in a different job, and I had kind of mentored and worked with Rebecca Jules, and she took over the youth governance at UNN. And so now, I was working with Vancouver Coastal Aboriginal Planning Committee and realized that wasn't quite happy there either, that my passion is working in our urban communities and advocating for urban Aboriginal people. And that advocating for urban Aboriginal youth translates into other, you know, community advocacy, because if you're advocating for youth, anything that affects youth affects our community. So from there, I decided, and I talked to Dave Dennis, who I've known since back in my days where I was an activist with the Native Youth Movement, and we decided that we were going to run. And some of the things, reasons why we wanted to run is that we don't agree with how politics is happening with urban Aboriginal people right now in our province. Right now, if you're an Aboriginal person, you'll probably hear the term new relationship. You'll probably hear about the Leadership Council. And what's happening is the province is engaging the Leadership Council on provincial matters. It could be Ministry of Children and Families, it could be health, and all these things are going on right now. And what's happening is, unfortunately, is they're not approaching the urban Aboriginal community. The Leadership Council is made up of various organizations, and they're all made up of BC First Nation chiefs. And I admire the unity of the organizations that did come together to make up the unity, or the Leadership Council. But when I engage young people across the province, a lot of them asked, why isn't the Métis and the UNN on that Leadership Council? That to have a true provincial Leadership Council, it should encompass all the provincial Aboriginal organizations in the province. And so that's one of the reasons that we're running, is to try and raise more awareness around urban Aboriginal issues, which also lead to our demographics, because about 70% of the Aboriginal population live in urban centers now. And out of that population, I'd say about 62% are under the age of 25. So you have this huge population of Aboriginal people living in urban centers, and the majority of that are youth. And so a lot of those youth aren't involved with decisions that are going on provincially, whether it has to do with health, education, Ministry of Children and Families, justice, the list goes on. And those young people have a right to be involved with those decisions, and should be involved. So that's one of the things. The other thing is that youth and elders, I feel elders are in the same category. I think that youth and elders are the most tokenized people in our community. And they are seen, but they're not heard. And so Dave and my platform is going to focus on youth, elders, and women, because Aboriginal women also fall into this category. And so much like the youth governance initiative we've started, we want to start an elders initiative like that will start creating elder roundtables and an elder executive, as well as a women's roundtables and a women's executive, and that they would have positions on the board of directors that give direct input into the governance of the organization. We have put forward a special resolution to change the governance structure of UNN to bring it, right now it's in 9 zones, and we want to bring that down to 5 zones, and that those people are elected at the AGM, because right now they're elected within their zones, and many of those board members haven't had an election in years. So really, it's a bit of a defunct board right now. They're still operating, but there hasn't been any community elections. So we want to bring the board down to 5. But we also are putting in another resolution that would have 3 more seats, an elder seat, and a male and a female youth seat, so that we'd have a board that represents our community a bit more. So you would have that youth voice, and you would have that elder voice. And then I think once the women's roundtables were brought, probably at a future AGM, that the 9th seat would be a woman's seat. So you'd have a 9-person board. And we're very frustrated right now because the people are, I guess I don't know, some of the people that are running UNN right now and that we're running against are denying people membership. And so we've been doing campaign barbecues and meetings, and some people don't have ID. Some homeless Aboriginal people or some Métis people don't have the proper ID to prove you're an Aboriginal person. So we had David Eby from Pivot Legal help us out and did affidavits recently for 4 people that were in the situation. And we just found out that the board of directors of UNN has decided not to honor these affidavits or memberships. And also there was supposed to be a youth summit, which I helped create, get some of the funding for. And so last year we had a youth summit prior to the AGM that had 20 youth, and this year it would have been more, and they decided to cancel the youth summit. So right now I feel like they're trying to really squash any supporters for me and Dave, but I'm not worried at all. I'm quite confident that this will all come out and be spoke about on the floor, and I think that membership will make an informed decision at the AGM. And I hope that membership votes for people that are grassroots and that work in our community. So I work in the community, and I know the organizations and struggles that they're going through, and they're all fighting for survival right now, just to keep
it going. There you go. So listen, Kelly, I hate to cut you short.
Yeah.
I'm going to have you on in the future in this program, but our time is coming close to the end. So,
okay.
And it is at the end, Dale was just telling me. So, Kelly, I really appreciate you coming on, and we're going to thank you very much for being our guest on Métis Voices radio program. It's been a pleasure to have you with us and an opportunity to chat with you, plus within the future. And I wish you all the best of luck in the future for your campaign. I know you are going to get in there, do your job, and true to the people. Thank you, Kelly.
Thanks a lot, Dale, and thanks for having me on. And like our slogan says, it's time for change.
You betcha. Thank you, Kelly. I also would like to thank the listeners for tuning in, our directors, and our sponsors of the BBS Radio for allowing us to present this program to you each week. Please send feedback about Métis Voices Radio. Next week, we are going to be in the Williams Lake for a gathering and a picnic. So we are putting on one of our archive programs for you listening enjoyment. Marcy, thank you very much. Good night.